This is a sermon given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website at saintdave.org.
All right, folks, I'm going to get us started. So welcome to this second of a two-part series where we're exploring the connections between faith and activism. And Diane Hardy Garcia, our Director of Community Engagement and Advocacy, has done a great job of putting together some fabulous panelists, and she's going to be introducing them here in just a moment. But let me just remind you that this will conclude this two-session series, and then we start in on our focus for Lent next Sunday, and Father Chad has a great sermon about what our plans are and what our journey is going to be as a parish during Lent, and it's just a fabulous sermon on prayer, too, so I commend it to you. But we will be focusing on the prayer life of Jesus during Lent, and that's what we'll be doing here in Crail C, is looking at his prayer life and how his prayer practices inspire and inform our own as we are intentional about that in the season of Lent. And so clergy and staff from St. David's will be our Crail C presenters for the Sundays in Lent. And then Wednesday nights, we'll be looking at the practices of prayer, so being a little more practical about what are some different ways of praying, like the daily office, the Anglican Rosary, those kinds of things. So that's the path ahead for us for Lent. So we hope to see you in Crail next Sunday. Father Chuck will kick us off on that series on the prayers of Jesus next Sunday. But for now, let's turn our focus to faith and activism. So Diane?
Thank you. I wanted to introduce you to our speakers today. The first is Lakidru Blaylock, who's been here before, but she is a dear to me. She is the senior chapter chair for the Texas Incarcerated Families Association, and she's got does amazing work on behalf of families who have loved ones who are incarcerated, and it's just been a joy to work with her over the last year. And of course, it's not easy work. So I'm so grateful that she's here. Rabbi Denise Ager is an old friend that I knew in a previous life. She is a longtime civil rights leader and LGBT advocate, the founding rabbi of Congregation Kol Ami. Her resume is too long to read, but she is also the past president of the Central Conference of American Rabbis. So I'm so grateful she's here today. We knew each other. Kol Ami is a congregation in West Hollywood, a temple in West Hollywood, California, and we knew each other from there, too. Reverend Kyle Riley is a new friend, and we have gotten to know each other a little bit by working at Texas Impact. And I'm so impressed with Reverend Riley's work with the reproductive rights efforts by Texas Impact. He's a reproductive rights advocate and public witness mobilizer with Texas Impact. So thank you for being here today. So we're continuing this effort to focus on activism and faith, and we wanted to bring in people who are doing the work now, or have been doing the always doing the work now, and talk about how their faith sustains them. Last week we talked about how that faith brought them to this work and was the cornerstone of why they were doing activism. And now we want to focus on how faith sustains our activism. How do we turn to our faith in hard times? Because it might be a little hard right now. Any of you feel that way? Maybe just a little bit. So we want to turn to a couple of people who I know, and as I follow them and look at their work, really rely on their faith. And so that's how we came about choosing these speakers. And so we wanted to explore that with them and hope that it gives you some ideas as you, you know, explore your faith and activism journey. All right, so I'm going to turn to you guys now. As faith-inspired activists, can you describe the type of work that you've been most involved with so you can tell folks a little bit more about what you do? I'm going to start with, who wants to start?
Go.
Oh, on the hot seat.
Go.
So,
you start.
Again, I'm LaKedra, and I'm with the Texas Incarcerated Families Association. And one of the things that what we do through TIFA is that we help organize, educate families, and support them that they have an incarcerated loved one. Can you imagine being a mom who has a 22-year-old that receives life without parole? Because I can't. So being able to help those families journey and let them know that, you know, it's okay to sit in the level of pain and the level of hurt and frustration that they're in, but then taking them through the journeying with them. And so being able to rely on my faith to journey with them through that, where I don't get self-consumed and start thinking about my own boys and start thinking about if it was me. My faith gives me the opportunity to journey with them, let them be where they are in that moment, but then begin to pray for them, begin to intercede on their behalf, and then being able to go to the legislators, being able to go to the representatives and going to the communities and saying, this is what it looks like when you have a community in poverty. This is what it looks like when you have gun violence that is not controlled. And so TIFA is really, we work a lot in the prisons, but we also work in the communities, because what we want to do, we're not just about what happens while they're in prison, but we try to be preventative as well.
Shalom, y'all. As Diane said, my major activism has been in the LGBTQ plus community. And I think I couldn't do any of the work that I've ever done without a grounding in my Jewish values, mm-hmm. which informs my faith. Mm-hmm. And it is what has sustained me for decades now. I founded my congregation in West Hollywood. I became a rabbi in the height of the AIDS HIV crisis in the mid to late 80s. And to be 28 years old, and all you're doing in your first acts of ministry is going to bed to bed to hospital to watch young men at the primarily gay men, because I served in the LGBT community in the world's first gay synagogue as its rabbi, as the first openly gay person to serve as its rabbi. And there was such shame and such isolation and such homophobia and such oppression. But I was seeing people who were my age or younger. Mm-hmm. Nobody in seminary taught me about that. And so I had to become an advocate for people who had no voice. Mm-hmm. And also in that time period, and continues on till today, as I'm sure Kyle will be able to address, is that, you know, the LGBT issues are never over. Mm-hmm. We think we get somewhere to a moment, a taste of equality, mm-hmm. a taste of dignity, and then we're slammed right back. Mm-hmm. So to keep doing that, you have to have a strong inner prayer life, faith life, value systems. And for me, that's a spiritual value system of Judaism. And I'll just say this and stop and turn it over to my friend here. You know, when I know you know that your clergy wear vestments when they are worshiping and leading worship. Rabbis do too. We have a prayer shawl that looks a lot like your stole, or maybe it's the other way around. I'm not sure. But on the collar, this is like a practical moment of faith development. On the collar of my tallit, my prayer shawl, I always had made and inscribed the verse from the prophet Micah. What does God require of you?
Come.
Only to do justice, mm-hmm. to love mercy, and walk humbly with my God. I was always enwrapped by the words of this prophet because it grounded everything mm-hmm. that I did as a Jewish person, as a faith leader in my ministry. Mm-hmm. And it's still my guiding mission statement today.
I'll say amen to that.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Amen. All right.
So I am a, I work for Texas Impact. I'm a public witness mobilizer, like Diane shared. Currently, my portfolio includes reproductive rights issues and LGBTQ rights at the legislature. My background to get into this work is simply being a trans person in West Texas. Mm-hmm. And I really quickly was taught by the people around me that I had to choose between my faith and my queer identity. Mm-hmm. And I chose my queer identity. And then I went to college and I found other queer people of faith and found that I didn't have to choose between those two things. And I had always wanted to get involved in activism and, you know, being up in the Panhandle area and seeing all of the anti-trans bills in 2017 and all of those things happening. I wanted to be involved so badly, and I had no idea how to do those things. And I found myself really rediscovering my faith and my identity as a queer person and being confident in that happening at the exact same time. And it brought me to this wonderful place of learning that I could do this as a profession and that I could do this as something that was within me and that I could use my power as a Christian clergy person to make change in the world by being a voice that is very often privileged, mm-hmm. But having a different message than the one that we often hear. So,
awesome. You were just ordained.
I was just ordained February 2nd. So.
All right. Wow. Okay, so each of you is involved in... how do I say this? You are involved in forms of advocacy that we would not consider easy. Is that the nicest way to say it? You're involved in the tough fights. I mean, sometimes it's hard to believe, Lakidru, that some of your issues are that this hard. I mean, fighting for the 85 to stay alive bill, the one to air condition Texas prisons. Mm-hmm. The fact that we haven't done that in Texas is shocking. Mm-hmm. And I am proud to share that St. David's, as a church, is taking a stand on that legislation. We have, our vestry has voted that we as a church will advocate for air conditioning Texas prisons. So mm-hmm. that is one of our priorities. Yeah. But the fact that... you know, so many of the things we have to fight for, mm-hmm. for criminal justice reform are so hard. Mm-hmm. You know, those, it's just unbelievable. And then we know the battle on LGBTQ mm-hmm. equality issues are always difficult, especially here. And reproductive health, shockingly mm-hmm. difficult. So each of you is involved in very daunting tasks. How has your faith sustained you when you constantly are up against what is... a tough task, you know, what is, you know, an uphill climb?
I think for me, one of the scriptures that my great-grandmother taught me was Philippians 4:13, which is what I've taught my boys. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And she's taught me in a way, I can do all things through Christ that strengthens me, Philippians 4:13. And so it's something that I recite, but it is something that has become a part of who I am. So even though we have to fight the giant of Texas just to get air conditioning in prisons, I believe that it will happen. We have made some headway. We've moved the needle. And I know my faith has taught me, my faith without works is dead. I can believe, but if I don't put feet to my faith, nothing will happen. So I know that I stand on the word and then I keep moving. I stand on the word and I keep moving. I know that if I believe it, I can see it. And if I say it, I'm going to see it. Mm. If I say it, I'm going to see it. And so that's what happens. And God has proven himself time and time and time again. And so I believe that even in this situation, I believe that.
God bless. I need to see an amen on that one too. Amen. All right.
I think, you know, I already mentioned the grounding in my Micah verse,
yes,
not dissimilar to yes, the Philippians verse, but I think that you have to have a really clear sense of your values matrix, mm-hmm, to do this work in a sustaining way. What are the sacred values that guide you to make the world a better place, mm-hmm, right? That's certainly what Jesus tried to do. That's certainly what my tradition teaches, that we have obligations to heal the world. And at the foundation of that is that every human being is born in God's image. Mm-hmm. I don't care who they are, their station in life, what place they live. And if you let those things guide you, mm-hmm, and guide your faith and reflect on them through prayer and study, I don't understand how it can't lead you out,
right,
to help make that transformation. Absolutely. I think that's the thing about advocacy, about social justice ministry. Mm-hmm. It's grounded in building the inner structure of your faith. Absolutely. And for me, you know, when I look at the world around us, it is so easy to get cynical. Mm-hmm. It is so easy to get skeptical. We're fighting the same battles over, who thought that we would be fighting about reproductive justice again? Does anybody who was around in the 70s think that we would be here again? I certainly didn't. So how do you fight that battle again? Mm-hmm. Some of us already defended clinics a long time ago, mm-hmm, and continue to do so. And just to get people the health care that they need. It's, mm-hmm, right? It's health care.
Right.
It's healthcare. Mm-hmm. So to do this again and again and again, to make change, you have to have something that is that scaffolding inside of you, mm-hmm, that holds you. And that, for me, is faith. Mm-hmm. And my belief, as my friend here said, that miracles didn't stop with the Bible. Mm-hmm. Miracles still happen. We have a hand in helping make that happen.
Absolutely. Amen. I couldn't hold it.
I think for me, one of the things that has really guided me is the concept that we are charged to do something, mm-hmm, about what we see in the world going wrong, and we are not responsible for fixing the whole of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that especially in our time where everyone has to make a statement about every single thing on Instagram, and you have to share and come out about every single issue, mm-hmm, it feels as though you solely are responsible for fixing, mm-hmm, every single problem, and that can't be true. Mm-hmm. And that is exactly how you burn yourself out.
Mm-hmm.
It's how you are unable to do this for a long period of time. And I think that it has shown me that even if I work at this for the next 50 years and I make very little progress, that's okay. That progress was important.
Mm-hmm.
I built some brick for someone else to build on top of, but it wasn't my responsibility to do it all.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't turn away from it is the other part of that, right? You can't see what's happening out there and turn your back and ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
You are, by faith, required to do something.
Right.
Makes sense. Now, you guys have already named a couple of things, but we had a question about, is there a principle or a prayer or a tradition from your faith practices that has helped you remain committed to activism? Is there, you already named Micah, and you named some, but is there anything else that you particularly cling to?
I think for me, Jeremiah 29:11, I think, you know, when he says, for I know the plans that I have towards you. And so when he talks about, I know the plans that he has towards me, but also the plans that he has towards the people that I serve, the communities that I serve. I know that he wants them to prosper and be in good health. Circumstances and situations may have caused something, the detour. But one of the things that I always remember is that the contributing factor is not the determining factor. The determining factor is the faith in what the word says. And that's just what I stand on. So if I know what his word, I believe what it says. So I know that Jeremiah 29:11 is true. And so those are the things that keep me going. Those are the things that I know that in spite of what I see and what it looks like, I know that he wants us to be in a better space than we are in. And just like Kyle said, it's my responsibility to do my part. Ms. Denise is doing her part. Kyle is doing his part. But it is my responsibility to do what I'm supposed to do. And if I focus on that, then I can stay grounded and I won't be all over the place, because I've been all over the place before.
I hear you on that one. I know this week when we put our giant t-shirt display up, you know, and it was just one thing that we could do, you know, mm-hmm. our Vitas Robotis installation that we did with Texas Impact. And, you know, it's just one thing we could do. We can't solve the whole thing, but we can speak out, you know. And I think it felt empowering for those of us who got a chance to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, just one thing. I totally understand that concept. What can we do? What yes. one thing? What mm-hmm. step forward?
Absolutely.
Well, I'm gonna give you the Jewish framework for what both of my colleagues said. In the Talmud, in the Mishnah, there's a saying in Hebrew, Lo alecha halecha ligmor. You don't have to finish the task, but you're not free to desist from it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is exactly what they both said.
Yeah.
And I think I would say also for me, because it's not, though my primary advocacy has been in LGBTQ+, because that's where I found myself in that role, and I had to be an advocate for my people who didn't have a voice, and then it kind of snowballed from there. But I've worked on significant other issues in reproductive health and women's rights and interracial relations and interfaith relations. And I would say actually my interfaith relationships with people of faith from other traditions has also kept me going in the darkest of times, because I can find folks who share not my faith but similar values that helps reinforce my own faith in my unique expression of it. And in community, I mean, faith is, I mean, we don't have hermits and monks in Jewish tradition. We just don't. Everything we do is in community. Mm-hmm. And so for me, in the interfaith interaction of that community, it actually sustains me for the long haul and helps me to reinforce and think reflectively about my faith and why I'm doing what I'm doing to help make the world a better place. So I would say it's not just the text, not just the biblical text, or in my tradition, the Talmudic text. It's also in that relationships mm-hmm. between faith communities that have some shared values.
Mm-hmm. Will you repeat the question, Diane? Sorry. I got so involved in it. I was like, wow.
Well, do you have any... Is there a particular faith-based prayer, tradition, or practice that has helped you remain committed to your activism?
Yeah, I think there's a few. I have really found that being in activist spaces with other clergy folks has been very sustaining. Just seeing other people show up mm-hmm. for the same issues. At Texas Impact, we're an interfaith organization, and seeing that shared values is what we all come together on. And just seeing people from all walks of life come and take part in something based on those things, it's something that's so rare to see right now. Mm-hmm. And I think it's beautiful. I think that I also really rely on my community. I thought I was not a big community person. I thought I was very individual and didn't want to be out and extroverted and all of that stuff, but I am so deeply reliant on my community. Mm-hmm. I need them to refill me, mm-hmm. and to be a positive light and experience for me in the midst of all that is going on and all the things that we have to address. Mm-hmm. And so those things have been just so incredible. And I'll share too, I think that one of the things that I didn't learn in my tradition growing up, I was in a Methodist community, and I always understood prayer to be something that happened out loud or that happened within and was very much like you were speaking to a friend. And I, in seminary, learned a lot about different types of prayer. And one of my favorite things is called Lectio Divina. And I see a lot of heads nodding. That's very good. Great job. It's a repetitive meditative process of reading scripture and contemplating it and also just saying it out loud as a prayer, because our scriptures are prayers in a lot of ways. They're holy messages to us. And so reflecting on those and being in that space with the text in a different way than I was used to has been something that I have been so grateful to learn.
Yeah. Building on that, Kyle, because that's a little bit what the next question is about. You know, so many of us, and I know each of you, although, you know, you're more well-known for a particular area of activism, you are all involved in a multiplicity of areas of activism. And at this time we're all being called in every possible direction. I mean, I know for us in the advocacy group, we're covering a ton of topics right now, and where do we put our time and how do we not be overwhelmed? And almost every time we come to the meeting, we're like, wow. What do we do? And I'm sure every one of you, every time you're reading the news, it's like so overwhelming. Is there a spiritual practice that you do regularly that helps with overwhelm? You just shared that. Is there another thing? Or we'll start with you this time and go back.
Yeah, so I recently learned to crochet, which has been very fun. I am on a yarn embargo in our house because I've bought way too much, and my fiance says it has to stop. But I have found that doing creative outlets is something that I kind of lost touch with, and I lost touch with it and realized it was also one of the darkest periods of my life that I was not being creative. And I said, well, that just seems to be connected. That seems like something I've got to find again. And especially getting into this work, one of the main things that I was told from everybody who could get their hands on me said, make sure you take time for yourself. And we were talking about this before we got started. Mm-hmm. Make sure you have something for yourself that you are doing that is not you giving another part of yourself away to this work. You have to keep something and to keep doing it. And so right now it's crochet, but I also call myself a serial hobbyist. So it's everything under the sun, but finding some way to let myself be creative and get out of my head and also get back into my body is just, it doesn't sound particularly like a faith spiritual practice, but it very, very much is. Mm-hmm.
For me, after having been a pulpit rabbi for nearly 40 years and showing up to worship professionally, mm-hmm. My wife is also a rabbi and is the senior rabbi at Temple Beth Shalom here in Austin. And so I don't have to lead the worship anymore.
Amen.
But the practice of the Sabbath, of Shabbat, is always important in our family. But also now, as a layperson in the pew, has taken on a really a different level for me of being able to receive in worship as opposed to being the outputter in worship. And so I would say for me, going to worship regularly every week, not as the preacher, not as the officiant of ritual, but to receive, to sing together with the community, has really become, for the last couple of years now, my recharge and my go-to. And I've gotten more observant now, not being the leader of worship, but being in the pews mm-hmm. with our prayer book, with community, when we go home for a Sabbath meal. I would say that.
Wow. I think I will echo what Ms. Denise said, because, I mean, my mother is an apostle. My dad, you know, everybody was a preacher. So I'm a PK, what they call a preacher's kid. So there were expectations on me. I was a praise and worship leader. I taught the women of destiny. I did this, that, and I was like, I'm sick of this. And I think being in position when I decided to step down from those roles, being able to come to church and enjoy praise and worship with someone else leading, because now I'm focusing on getting poured into instead of making sure that other people get what they need from God. And now I was actually in a position where I was getting fed and didn't realize I really needed some feed. And so that really helped. And then when I realized that prayer was just talking to God, it was simply communication with God, because I had this image of what it should look like, because my mother did it so well, and then everybody did it so well. And I was like, God is my homie, and I can talk to him like I'm talking to a friend. And when I realized that, I immediately started hearing him, because I was being so open and honest with him like I would a friend. And then he started responding, and I was more open to hear him, because I was so focused on the logistics and the technicality of it, trying to get it right, that I wasn't even really hearing him. So yeah, just being out of that place where I can receive and being more free to worship, being more free.
What do you mean by that?
Being in a place where I feel like I can just be unapologetically and authentically me, not feeling that I can be vulnerable. My vulnerability is not going to be exploited. Not feeling like I have everybody else's responsibility of receiving and hearing from God on my shoulders. I was just free to worship.
Great. All right, before we open it up to everybody, I was going to just ask, I know, is there any particular way we can support your work? I'll make some plugs for how we can support
Tiffa. So with TIFA, we're the Texas Incarcerated Families Association. If you know of any families that have a loved one that is currently incarcerated or going to leave the county jail in any city in Texas, you can have them go to TIFA.org. I left some brochures on the table. Have them to go and become a member of TIFA. Get involved with the work that we're doing. We also meet here at St. David's. So if you all know some family members that need a support group, they're here at St. David's. So just, yes, ma'am.
Isn't the Del Valley Jail air conditioned? Because my son's been there a lot, and he's always complaining about being too cold and stuff.
Yeah, so in TDCJ, the issue is that they're too hot. They don't have any air conditioning. In the county jails are air conditioned, but the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, if you're not a warden or a major, no, I see.
Really
cold in Del Valley. Yeah. Yeah, normally in the counties, they keep it really cold because they say that helps with the germs. But we are fighting for air conditioning in the Texas prisons.
Oh, okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. All right. So you can support, and you can also donate to TIFA.
Yes.
And just help contribute to their work.
Yes.
Is there anything you would like to add? I do. I mean, Diana, as I just became the interim executive director of an organization called A Wider Bridge. And what that organization does is connect the Israeli LGBTQ plus community to the North American LGBTQ plus community, and also fights anti-Semitism within the LGBT community, which has just grown exponentially, particularly since October 7th, has always been there. And so it's called A Wider Bridge. And what's interesting about the Israeli LGBTQ community and the organizations there is it doesn't just serve Jewish Israelis. All of the organizations serves Israeli Arabs, serves Palestinians, as well as Jewish Israelis. And it is a place of shared social society and civic society. And so if you want to learn more, The website is A Wider Bridge, W-I-D-E-R, bridge, all one.org, to learn more about what we do and help we make impact grants to all the organizations in Israel who serve the entire population of Israel.
I love that.
And for Texas Impact right now, I'm in charge of our reproductive rights campaign. We're working on fixing the Texas abortion ban, which we, of course, would love if it was repealed. But our current objective is just to make sure people aren't dying because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a postcard campaign going on right now that we are trying to really encourage authors or legislators to take part in the legislative process and push forward these bills that will fix the laws that are currently in place to provide doctors the ability to practice medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our main objective right now. And you can also take part in any of our other portfolio objectives. So we have several issues. We work on gun violence, climate, immigration, LGBTQ rights, and public education. So any of those things, we're always happy to have more people get involved with us.
You have information?
Yes, there's information on the table. There's the postcards. You can sign a physical postcard and return it to us. And there's also brochures about Texas Impact.
They Texas Impact particularly needs, and I don't know if, you know, in Austin, our folks are pretty good on the reproductive health issues. But if you have family members or friends in Senate District
yes.
1, that's up by Tyler, Texas, mm-hmm. and East Texas, and House District 1, they're trying to get people to call their representatives from there and sign the postcards from there. So if you happen to have family members up by Rusk, Senate District 1, House District 1 is up in East Texas, they could really use some help identifying people up in that area.
Yeah.
Some of us have family members. So.
Yeah, if you know people in either of those areas, talk to me after.
Yeah.
Would love that.
That'd be great. All right, so I'm going to open it up to questions now. Do you have any questions for these guys? All right.
I was interested in when you realized that you were called, and what circumstances did that for you? You know, did you feel like you had to do it, or maybe you could do it versus something else? Thank you.
Well, I haven't answered the call to ministry quite yet in the way that most people, like my mother says that I'm supposed to be her co-pastor. So I'm just a minister now. And I thought that for a very long time, and I think I thought that because she was my mother, but then I realized that I have to hear the call. And so now I'm just operating in the capacity of a minister, and he's still moving. So it's a lot when people try to put that mantle on you, but I had to have the strength to say, no, I'm gonna move when he tells me to move.
Well, what about called to do your activism? I would say that is, I believe activism is
yes.
a call.
Yes,
yeah, absolutely. So I am the child of an incarcerated parent. I felt lonely, I felt ashamed, I felt isolated. And then one day I went to visit my dad in prison when I was 9. And there were a bunch of other kids there. And I thought, because I initially thought I would be the only one. And there were a lot of other kids there. And then I think it was, I was 25 when I realized that I needed to be a voice for those children, for the children like me, who didn't know who I was, who thought that who I was my dad's addiction, his inability to stay out of prison and stay sober. And when I realized that I could be a voice, that I went through that so somebody else doesn't have to. And it was at that moment I just started doing the work little by little, and then it turned into all of this.
All right.
I think we're called all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's one call.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say through the course of my more than six decades now, that call has shifted and changed mm-hmm. at different times. I think as a young person, I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, and Dr. King's assassination continues to weigh heavy on that city. And I think that shaped me very much. And my rabbi growing up was the rabbi head of the Interfaith Ministry Association in 1968. And that he was the one that invited Dr. King to come help settle the sanitation strike, which ultimately ended his life tragically by murder and assassination. And I think those factors, to be honest with you, when I saw what he was able to do and to make the demands and march, take the people the day after and march down the main street, mm-hmm. go to the mayor's office to say, enough, this cost was too high, that had such an impact on me as a child. Like today, I mean, I can see I'm still emotional about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one call to know that I had an obligation to be a change point in the world. I didn't know if I knew about ministry at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So, but at different points, and I've already mentioned the AIDS crisis and what that was to be an advocate and put in a situation, but my mission continues to change and my calling, and mm-hmm. I think part of it is just to be open to that, hearing that voice mm-hmm. call you.
Yeah.
I think that's really similar experiences that you both shared to my understanding of a call. I think one of the values that I learned in seminary was the distinction between a call and a vocation. And a call is what you're called to in this moment. And a vocation is more like the arc of your life and what you do with it. And I think that's exactly right. I think that a call can be something official, like my call to ministry and my ordination. But I think a call to this work of working with incarcerated families, I think a call that a lot of activists in secular spaces feel is the same thing, whether we use different language or not. But I think for me, the call right now is to reproductive rights and LGBTQ rights in this advocacy space at the legislature. But I think it's important to always be open to a different call and to see how that shifts.
Excellent.
I don't know if I'm going to reach all the way
tonight. Okay, so I'm going to preface this by letting y'all know that I'm a lobbyist. That's what I do for a living. And the background that I've had with policies, both in public education funding for property poor school districts and Medicaid recipients. And we've done other things as well, but those are two of the bigger areas. What do y'all do to help prevent looking at some of the policies that get implemented and seeing the impact on an individual that those policies have and saying, that's just about as evil as it can be? And not demonize the people that are implementing. Still seeing the spark of God in those people.
Because
mm-hmm. sometimes I have a hard time with that.
Yeah.
So any help is appreciated.
Wow.
That is a tough question.
It's a really tough question.
Yeah.
I'm not good at it. True confession. When someone's coming after me and my personhood to take away, dehumanize me and take away my humanity or others that I'm working with, it's really hard not to get caught up in exactly what you described. Mm-hmm. And you have to take a moment of pause and prayer, I think, in those moments, because I don't want to then dehumanize someone else when that's their language, right? It's their language of cruelty. And so to overcome that, that's when you have to dig down deep in your faith and use those prayer tools that Dr. West is teaching you and your clergy staff are teaching you to forge forward, and almost having to ignore their evil to try and have that to keep your humanity. Mm-hmm. Right? You have to keep your humanity in this and never lose sight of the people that you're fighting for, not just against. Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately that will give you the grounding, at least it has for me, because I've met some people who've been incredibly cruel. I was the first openly gay person to be president of the entire, I was like the presiding bishop for 2 years. I'll speak Episcopalian. I was the presiding bishop, we don't have bishops, for Reformed Judaism. We do a two-year cycle. And I was the first openly gay person to do that, the first gay person to do that. And it's worldwide, even though it says Central Conference of American Rabbis. It's all the Reform rabbis all over the world. And I was only the third woman. So, you know, lots came my way. In the Jewish newspaper in Los Angeles, I was the lesbian pig rabbi. In the Jewish press. Right, like this is the press for the whole Jewish community, not just the Orthodox Jewish. So, like, what do you? That's even internally, just in my people. That's not just the homophobes in the evangelical right, right? Like that, yeah. Right? You expect from them. I didn't expect it from my own people. So, how do I not dehumanize those who are trying to dehumanize me? You have to have your faith system, and your prayer system built. To keep doing it. So thank you for doing the holy work that you're doing. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. I think I agree with Miss Denise. It's hard. It really is, because it just in the African American community, a lot of times people they have so many unconscious biases and they project that on you, and so you have to navigate all of that. And I think having safe spaces or having, you know, community where I can go and say the things that I really want to say to that individual, it helps. But it's hard. It really is, because you know that what they're doing is tearing down a group of people. They don't really have a lot of information. They're just basing it on what either they were taught or stereotypes. And so you have to, like Ms. Denise said, is to dig deep. And know that it's not about you. And I often think they're operating out of a space of ignorance. And so if I really want to be a difference maker, maybe not only in the lives of the people that I'm serving, but show up in a way that it may also change the person that is trying to dehumanize me.
Beautiful. I think that so far I've had the privilege that this is remained the case for me, and I have a feeling the longer I'm in this will become more and more difficult to hold on to. But I feel like I've approached all of this working with these legislators, especially, you know, going into offices about a completely different issue, knowing that these people have authored and passed bills against anti-trans legislation. And I'm walking into this office, and quite frankly, they typically have no idea, right? And they've got signs on their computer screens that say trans people aren't real or something like that. Like, and I'm not making that up. No. And so walking into those spaces, knowing that is a thing, and then having to work with them, right? I'm like, all right, we're gonna find something else about this other issue, and we're gonna make progress. And I think it's drawing, like Denise said, on that humanity of the other person, and hoping that it's still there, and knowing, no matter what their reaction is, like, I have to do it for myself. Mm-hmm. I have to do it for my own humanity, and I have to do that because they're not going to take away another thing from me. Mm-hmm. So I'm approaching it, you know, it's one of those, like, you talk to someone with the nicest attitude that you can, and if they're rude to you, then it's really on them, right? Like, mm-hmm. it's you do your best to be the best version of yourself in that moment, and then if they still can't behave, then that's not your fault anymore, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that those things have been helpful for me. I think there's also this feeling of just wanting to shake somebody and just say, listen, right? Like, listen to what I'm telling you about the hurt that these things are causing. And just wake up, right? Like, your things that you are doing are causing harm. And again, I think it's that I still have this belief that if we tell them that enough times, if we wake them up, they'll realize that what they're doing is harmful and bad and hurting people. And I think if I lose that, I'll come back to you and give you a different answer. But mm-hmm. but that's what it is for me right now, is hoping that there's still someone in there to mm-hmm. to be talked to in that way, to be leveled with about the humanity of other people.
Mm-hmm. I think one for me is that when I've been doing this activism for a while myself, and it's remembering those that I've seen change. Mm-hmm. And I have seen many people change. Mm-hmm. Big ones. Like Warren Chisholm voting for the hate crime bill. That was huge that we finally got his vote. And you probably remember Warren Chisholm. So there are times where I've watched people make changes in their lives, epic ones, and reminding me of that. You know, that people do change.
It's possible.
And there was a great... So I kind of always tell myself, all I have to keep doing is keep talking. Just keep myself in conversation. Go back to the people that I need to scream my head off. And like you said, yeah. I got to say all my explicitives somewhere other place. But be able to remain in conversation and try to remember they have children and find mm-hmm. what I have in common and remain mm-hmm. there. But I always do believe and hold on to the belief that change is possible. And I've witnessed it. So find those places where you can witness the change and hold on to them.
I want to give a shout-out to an organization, and then I want to ask a question. Mm-hmm. The shout-out is the Seedling Program mm-hmm. is a wonderful way to get involved with a child whose parent is incarcerated.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
And okay. This is my third year, and it's been very rewarding. Now, a question. So there were hundreds of things that outraged me in the last month. And I just got overwhelmed. And then somebody told me about a website called democracy.io. You put in your address, out pops your three representatives, two from Senate, one from Congress. It has a format. So what I've been doing is when I read something in the Washington Post or the New York Times that is just outrageous, I take it and plop it in there, put it in my own words, and say, what are you doing about this? Or do you really believe this? Or some other question. So my question is this. Am I doing what my grandma called spitting in the breeze? Is there any value to sending emails?
I will say in my... To be frank, my limited experience, okay? This is my second session, my first official one. I think there is value in nice terms, bothering the offices. I think, yeah, I heard someone talking the other day about, we can't pretend that this is normal.
Right.
We can't pretend that these things should be happening. Like, we have to keep moving and, you know, kind of ignore that, okay, that is crazy, but we also have to say, that is crazy. Mm-hmm. Like, we have to find a way to keep moving and doing other things that are impactful and, like, fighting against them. And, you know, we can't get chased down by all of the, I keep calling them, like, tennis balls for a Labrador or something, right? Like, we can't keep watching all of those things happen and letting it pull us away from the work. But we also can't ignore that they're insane. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're so much. There's 100 things that we could talk about, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think drawing attention to those and calling out that those are really just insane is helpful. But I would say, in addition to that, calling the offices is always more impactful. And the reason for that is that it takes someone's time. Mm-hmm. The emails take time, of course, but they can just, okay, that's, they're not going to read the whole thing. They're going to read, okay, yes, and then they're going to copy and paste there. We've heard your message. We'll get back to you. We promise we're working on this, blah, blah, blah. They have a boilerplate template for you. So that does take their time, but if you bombard that office, and not necessarily you, but you call every single day, don't call them like 12 times a day, but, you know, calling them every single day and then also having your friends call them about the issues, every one of their constituents has a right to call that office, and calling that office and taking time from their staff to have to answer constituent phone calls, they quickly realize that their people are concerned about this thing. Mostly because they want you to stop calling.
And they log those.
They log all of
them. Phone calls.
Yeah.
They don't log emails. And so whether it's the United States Congress or Senate or our legislature here, they log your calls. So yes, it takes more time. Pre-program your numbers in your phone. So you don't have to like go searching. Hit it once a day is enough. Once a day is enough, but log them and get everybody you know to keep calling them, especially while they're in session.
Yes.
Especially because it is insanity. Mm-hmm. It is insanity. We're living in insane times.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely the emails are fine. I think those are great. But I agree with Kyle and Ms. Denise that the phone calls, because they have to be logged, but and it also, like Kyle says, bring attention. And now the representatives and their staff are like, okay, these people really are concerned about this issue. We have to do something. We may be at risk of him getting voted out.
Right.
If we don't address it. Yeah. So that is definitely, I think the emails, but the phone calls, because I call everybody once a day.
Yeah.
I even have my 19-year-old calling out too. He don't really understand why, but he calls.
So on that topic, let me just give you like an action thing to do, okay? So Texas Impact, we have toll-free numbers that we use to track the number of calls that a legislator's office is getting, so that we can say, we know you've gotten 150 calls from our people about this specific thing in the last 2 days, and we'd love to, you know, have one of our team members come in and talk to you more about why we're having our people call you. So if you go to texasimpact.org, if you need, it's on the brochure as well, but our action center, we've got all of those toll-free numbers, and of course you can just put them in from the website, the Capitol website, find the office number, but this helps us track and know how many calls that office is getting about certain things, and so that can be really, really helpful. We've also got a sample script about how to call, like what an efficient call with your legislator should be. It's really most impactful to make it, you know, 2-3 minutes at most, just so you get your point across. You're not, you know, upsetting the office too much by being going on and on about your particular issue, but getting your points across, making your statement, and then it also helps you make so many phone calls in a short amount of time, and you can do it every single day. So
that's assuming that you're talking to a real person.
Yeah, so it'll be a real person. Yeah. And so, and if you get, sometimes their voice, sometimes they're full, but just call back 15 minutes later. You know, just
talking to a person in Cruz's office. I went in person.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes I miss fax machines.
I know. We used to do faxes.
Sometimes we used to do faxes because it would also clog up the lines and do it. Sometimes I miss them.
All right. All right. I think we have to wrap up, but I want to, is there, can I do one last question? One last question.
I was just going to say, I mean, who are we calling? How many people are we supposed to call? So the two senators and our congressperson?
Yeah, so I would encourage, so you can, of course, call your representatives in D.C. I would also really encourage calling everyone in the Texas Capitol. Yeah. So you have a
Texas
senator.
Legislature.
Yeah, so you have a senator and a representative.
Yeah.
You also, if you're calling about a specific issue, those members are on committees. So something that we also have in that action center is Senate and House assignments by committee.
Mm-hmm.
And so once that person is on a committee and your issue has been referred to that committee, you have every reason to call the offices of all of those members.
Mm-hmm.
So typically you wouldn't call someone who's not your legislator, but when it's a committee issue, you can call those offices and tell them that you're calling them because of their position on this committee.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how you would decide who to be calling.
Yeah.
So.
And for those of you who are members of the Advocacy Committee at St. David's, we'll be talking about particularly calling and showing up for the hearing on vouchers that's going to happen on March 11th coming up. So we'll be giving you information on that in the advocacy meeting. But if you're specifically interested in advocacy, our meeting's at 11:15 today. So if you want to come to that. All right, is there anything else? I want to thank you guys so much. You're the best.
To all of you.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.